Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's L-O-N-E-S-T-A-R Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning into Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 18, Episode 29. This week, Bob was joined by Kevin and Anya from the Murder Sheet podcast to discuss the Temujin Kenzu case from their perspective. This was an absolutely great conversation, and today, Kevin and Anya joined Bob, Janet, and I to discuss all your listener questions and theories. But before we get into that, do we have any housekeeping?
Yes, we've got one little piece of housekeeping before we get into this. What is bound to be a shit show with five of us in the room. The only thing is, though, Erica, who is our head transcriber, messaged me today and said that they've lost a couple of transcribers. So I know we always have a ton of people that are wanting to volunteer to help with that. They do have a probably we do some automation where they kind of get the everything transcribed, but then there's some, you know, editing and formatting and stuff they do so they can send them off to the inmates and stuff like that and publish them on the website. If you were interested in volunteering to be on the transcription team, shoot an email to theories@truthandjusticepod.com or just click the contact form on our website, and I will make sure that gets over to Erica. Different Erica. This is Erica with a C, not Erica with a CK. Erica 1, as we call her, that handles that. And with that said, Kevin and Ani, thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having us back.
Thanks for having us. We really appreciate the invitation and the opportunity. We had such a great time talking with you the other day.
Yeah, we did. And it's really nice to also get to meet Janet and Zach now. So we're very excited.
Yeah, we, truth be told, we talked for probably just as long off the air after the podcast as we did on the podcast last week when we recorded that. So I'm going to kind of, usually we kind of start off by sort of a round robin with Zach and Janet about, you know, their takes on the episode. This time we kind of had like Aaron, then we had you guys on. So I kind of want to do that first, since Anya and Kevin, the three of us, were part of it. We'll let them say what they think about us and we'll pretend like we're not here. So let's start with Zach. Any like burning thoughts or questions you had about the episode last week?
Well, I loved the conversation because a lot of the content that I have taken in for this case is on the innocent side. And it's very hard to find anything on the guilt side. Regardless of where you fall, it's very hard to find anything on the guilt side. So it was a very nice conversation to have and to hear all the theories. And really, it was wonderful to finally hear you guys and meet you guys with Bob. So I'm thrilled to have this conversation today. I do have a few questions, but I think we're going to let Janet talk first, and then I'll get into some of my questions and the listener questions.
Perfect. Janet, you have the floor.
Zach. Well, thank you. Yeah, Zach and I also have not consulted with each other to see if we have similar questions. I did get a chance to look at some listener questions, and there is a little bit of overlap, with a couple. So I'll let the listeners speak, you know, on my behalf for the stuff that I'm curious about. But first, I just wanted to really thank both of you. I've had the opportunity. I think I said it when Bob and I were talking before you guys had your conversation. I think I already called this out, but I really appreciate that you are giving voice to people who were victimized by Fred Freeman, Temujin Kenzu, who really get lost in this story. And I understand that for people who are really focused on the innocence piece, it's not certainly not helpful to explore that very much. But I can just imagine if I had gone through something like that and I just kept seeing stuff about how this, you know, great dude or this reformed person is, you know, rotting in jail and shouldn't be. And there's no mention of the person that he is, you know, while maybe, that can't play into what his conviction looked like at the time. The fact of the matter is that a ton of attention is being paid to him, and there's just not a lot of conversation about who this person is. And you know, in listening to your really compassionate coverage of people like Crystal, who even in some places where I wouldn't have expected it, like coverage I've listened to from people that I think do a really balanced job of talking about stuff or stay kind of clinical, I still sort of felt like the implication is always like, who's this kooky gal? Like, what's wrong with her? And it's a little disturbing. So I really appreciate you giving voice to, you know, some folks who just haven't really been heard from. And then in listening to the telephone conversations with him and then like the letter that he wrote to you, I'm just like, what? So this goes back to what we were talking about. And I do have some additional single questions, but maybe Zach and I can bounce back and forth and we'll make sure we hit the listener questions too. Is what I said in our follow-up last time. My feelings haven't changed, Bob, where I just still am really ethically torn about all the attention that this guy has gotten, because for me, in the precious time that we have and all the other stuff you have going on, it's just one of those things where I'm like, why are we fighting for this one? I mean, we're not, but it's hard, and it presses right up against the, like, what do I think? Do I think he did it? And beyond that, do I think he's worth saving? When what I know I need to be thinking is like the system. If he's an example of the system being broken, then it doesn't matter who he is. We have to fix the system. It's just that's a real quandary for me. I feel myself pushing up against that, being very uncomfortable with like, well, yeah, I mean, if he didn't do it, I guess he shouldn't be there. But also, like, I'm glad he didn't get a commutation. Like, I'm glad that his sentence wasn't commuted, because when you hear that people who testify in the commutation hearing, it's just like, I don't want this guy out on the streets, you know? Yeah. Anyway, that remains true for me today as it did last week.
Yeah. And I think that for me, because I've thought a lot about it since our conversation last week, Janet, on that. And I think there's another element of it too. And again, I'm not saying that he is innocent, but, you know, if we're considering that, right? Like, yeah, I think it's more than just the system, right? So it's more than just, if he didn't do it, we put our energy into getting this guy out. I think for me, the focus really would be, if he didn't do it, then that means Scott Macklem's murderer was never caught and brought to justice for this. And that deserves to happen too, right? Regardless of, you know, this asshole that's in prison. There's another person out there, also an asshole, who murdered him that needs to be, that needs to be brought to justice. If we're position where he is actually innocent.
Well,
I think Kevin and Anya. Oh, sorry, Zach.
Well, I think this leads into a perfect question that I have for Kevin and Anya. You know, you guys came to your conclusion based on, you know, the case file, interviewing witnesses. You know, I much respect how you guys went about it, and I do believe this case is being whitewashed, or Timogen himself is being whitewashed. But I want to ask you, why do you think it's happening? And with the caveat, I don't mean how it's happening. We can all see how it's happening. But why do you think it's happening?
That is such an excellent question, Zach. And from my perspective, I really do feel it is because there can be, true crime can sometimes be a little allergic to nuance. And I think we see this in the innocence movement. We see this actually in the anti-death penalty movement. A lot of people are anti-death penalty, but sometimes it's harder to argue, don't kill this guy, even though he obviously did this horrible thing, than it is to argue, no, this guy might be innocent, let's save him. People like a heroic, simple story that they can get behind. That helps with fundraising. It helps with activism. And it doesn't always leave a lot of room for shades of gray. And I think that is a shame, because I think there are cases where people who are bad people, who maybe have gang histories, or they made a lot of mistakes or did horrible things, could be facing overcharging or even a wrongful conviction. And, you know, we need to kind of be able to sort all that out.
I think that from my perspective, what I see, and it goes well beyond true crime, is there is a lack of intellectual honesty, I feel like, in general, in the world right now, that I hope conversations like this and things that can like help push back against that. You know, we don't necessarily disagree on this case, but you know, we have talked about having you guys come on and talk about the Delphi case, which we do disagree on. And I'm really looking forward to having that conversation. If for no other reason, for people to see that there can be a meaningful discussion, you know, a healthy debate about something without, you know, resorting to personal attacks and things like that. But I think that there is that lack of intellectual honesty comes in where, because we see the same thing in politics, right? It's like, I feel like my side, whatever side that is the right side. And so I'm not going to acknowledge anything bad my side does, because that will, I feel like that's going to affect my argument. You know, I can't say that, you know, yeah, this, my party did this thing or this thing and this thing, but also I still think they're right about this. It has to, it's like, we're in this like all or none society right now, I feel. I don't know, what do you guys think about that?
I couldn't have said it better myself. I think you've put your finger on something that's a problem in the world, and certainly something that's a real issue in the true crime community. We don't feel comfortable saying, well, this may be a bad guy, but we think he's innocent. We have to say this guy is an angel. He's a, think of all the wonderful things he could do to help all of us. He's such a brave and zen-like person. And that's just going too far. I wouldn't have any problem if somebody were to say, this is a horrible human being. I think he's a terrible person, but I just don't think he did this particular crime. I think that's an intellectually honest position. It's not a position I agree with, but it's an intellectually honest position. I don't have any problem with that. I have a problem with people saying this guy is a saint, which is something we've seen a lot of in coverage of this case.
Yeah, I agree. I'm right there with you in, like I said, even in society in general, because we see the same thing in true crime too, and the other way. You know, I've seen it, you know, I've covered and worked on intimately with the West Memphis 3 case for almost a decade now. And I see it all the time with like Damien Echols, the side that believes he's guilty, like just constantly just like painting him as this horrible, wicked, wretched, nasty person. And to which, you know, like, I mean, I know, because I know him personally, I've known Damien for a long time, is not true. And there's maybe grains of truth in some of the stuff they're saying that we know about him from when he was a teenager, you know, this and that, that you can put into it. But it's, yeah, we say, just like in politics, we see it with both sides, that they get everything always, and even for the content creators, I'm sure you guys have dealt with this. I know that we have, where it's like, you know, people take a position that where they disagree with us, especially me personally a lot. It's I'm biased, I'm this, I'm that, you know, it always turns into all these personal attacks. Like, you can't accept, people have a hard time, I think, accepting someone is either a good person who I disagree with or a bad person that I agree with. Like that's like, those are things aren't possible, and they should be.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
I have a couple of sort of specific things I would love to hear your takes on in terms of stuff that, like, for example, you know, this idea of finding significance in things that maybe didn't feel significant to you. And sometimes when people make them significant, they don't finish the thought of why they think it's significant. So I'm just wondering, like, what your point of view is. This is such a small one, but I'm just going to like pop around a little bit. But like, there's a lot of talk about like, oh, Scott, he was in the wrong parking lot. Why was he in the wrong parking lot? And I guess I don't even get why that's a thing. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, why is that? What does that mean? Anything at all, I guess. But I feel people that believe that Temujin is innocent point to that with like Scott's car and are like, guys, no, really pay attention to this. He wasn't in the right lot. And that's one of those things where I'm like, you're not telling me why that matters, and does it? And I'd love to hear what you guys think.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you asked about that. I feel like the parking lot thing is interesting. I think like any kind of deviation from someone's routine, the day they're murdered, I think it's worth talking about. But to me, we talked to Scott's friends, a bunch of whom actually went to this same exact community college. And I mean, you're not supposed to park in a lot where you don't have a pass. You could get, you know, a ticket, right? But
yeah.
Scott was seemingly late that day and he was going, you know, to this gym class, and that lot was a good place to park so we could go to the gym class. So I think it was just one of those things where it's like, you know, okay, I'm going to park here and, you know, wish me luck with the ticket thing. I don't think it's a really big deal. A lot of these lots are pretty close to each other, but to me, it just seems like one of those things where I'm sure if something horrible happened to Kevin and I, you could probably pick apart our whole day where we did something unusual.
Oh my God, I think about that all the time.
Right? You're like, oh my gosh.
Oh, this would be used against me. Yeah.
Like, why did they park over here and not there?
Is the argument
he was meeting someone or something?
Why
did it matter?
That if there was a plan to ambush him, that Scott didn't park where he normally parks, so how could someone have the plan? Is that the argument?
I think that probably is more likely than a meeting, because I mean, there's no indication. Like, he has his gym bag for his gym class and, you know, he's allowed to go to the second gym block. But one thing I will note is, having been in that parking lot, like, there are areas you could stand and get a pretty good vantage point all around if you know what car you're looking for. So, you know, if you don't quite know where someone's going to park, but you have a general idea of the area, I think, to me, it's just not a huge deal. I mean, again, I think it's okay for people to ask questions, maybe look at certain things, but to me, it's like, I don't know. I don't put a lot of significance on it.
And then another thing I was just going to say while we're on the subject of the parking lot and the kind of location where it happened, I was interested, you know, I've said this on the last follow-up, but I really enjoyed the conversation that you had with Brett and with Julia about this case. I can't remember if it was brought up in those episodes that you guys did together or if it was in the consult's independent coverage of it, but they sort of talk about this idea of like, oh, and I think Julia also said it in her conversation with Aaron from Framed, this idea that like this was a very like this that like that he's very chaotic and very confrontational and very kind of messy about how he has his confrontations or, you know, fights. And that this is like much cleaner and less personal. But I guess in my mind, I'm like, yeah, but you're choosing to do it in a parking lot of a college where like the parking lot was allegedly totally full of cars. Like, I can't think of a more stupid, reckless thing to do. So I guess I'm trying to understand, and I know you're not Julia, but like, I'm trying to understand the psychology of describing that action as like something that is like, a, you know, some kind of tight, clean. I mean, I know they acknowledge that it's a weird place too, but I guess that's another thing where like when you're sort of analyzing behavior, I'm like, I guess I don't see how somebody who like does rash things couldn't be responsible for rashly killing someone in a college parking lot with a bunch of people around.
Yeah, I think you've echoed our thoughts too. And it's certainly a lot of respect for Julia and her profile, and she's great. I mean, Consul's a great show. She does a great job.
Oh, totally.
We do have a disagreement though there, because we feel that Temujin is very capable of showing up with a shotgun and blasting someone. And, you know, is there a bit of cunning or lying in wait or patience that has to come with a murder like that? Yeah, but I think it's within his realm of capability to do it. And, you know, frankly, it's a murder type that's going to get him in and out quickly. And, you know, heading back to try to form an alibi as quickly as possible.
And just because a person tends to do rash things doesn't mean that everything they do in all aspects of their lives has to meet your own particular definition of a rash act. When you look at this guy's life and history, even when he's behind bars, he has come up with pretty complicated plans to harass and cause problems to other people. And if he's capable of coming up with plans like that, I think he's certainly capable of coming up with a plan to drive to a parking lot and shoot somebody.
Well, and even that doesn't necessarily have to be that thought out of a plan, I guess, to me. Like, it seems incredibly rash if you're like stewing over something and you're like, you want to kind of, you're like, I'm just going to drive there right now. And then like, you can't start your car. So you have to get someone to like, you know, jump your car. And then you're like, I'm still doing it. And like, oh, I'm doing it. And I'm going to do it. I'm going to drive. And then I'm going to get there in the morning. And, you know, I'm just going to take care of it. And like, I don't know. I mean, that, yeah, it all comes down to what you believe about the alibis, right? I mean, it really does come down to what you think specifically about that noon alibi. And I'm really on the fence about it. Zach, why don't you talk? I've been talking for too
well,
long.
Well, so I do have a question totally about alibis. So I was thinking about this and I haven't heard your coverage of it or at least this part of the coverage of it. How do you feel, and I apologize for the name, I'm probably going to butcher the name, the Beth Steyer alibi from the night before? What do you have any feeling about that? Because that's supposed to take place about 2 a.m., anywhere to 2 a.m. to 2:45, which makes it, I mean, I'm not, that means he would have to like leave immediately. You know, I just don't know how you guys feel about that.
Yeah, a lot of these alibis are pretty tight.
Mm-hmm.
The first credible alibi after the murder places him about 6.5 hours away, about 6.5 hours exactly after the time of the murder. So a lot of this stuff is pretty tight, but I still find it possible and even plausible, especially if it's a situation where he is trying to build an alibi and he's trying to have people there to vouch for him as much as possible during the important times.
One thing I've been wondering about, because I've gone over that bridge many times, I've been to Escanaba many times, is, you know, everybody keeps throwing around like a 6.5 hour time frame, but crossing that bridge, he was crossing it when I cross it. I used to have a hunting camp that I went to in the Upper Peninsula. So it's early November is when we were making that trip. And that bridge, that time of year, sometimes it can take hours to get across it sometimes. Has anybody ever checked into like the traffic patterns on the bridge that day? Because like, to me, like the idea of making that drive in 6 hours on November 5th seems really, really unlikely. I would put it closer to probably an 8 hour drive, because of the time of year it was and everything. So I don't know if anybody's ever looked into that, or if we're just always just working with this range. Like it could be 6 hours, could be 8 hours, somewhere in between there.
I believe detectives in their police files too, like talked about making that drive in the 6.5 hour range, you know, and obviously they would be incentivized to do it fast as possible.
Mm-hmm.
We've heard from people who said, well, I've done and it took me a lot longer, but then sometimes it's like, you know, we're stopping for dinner. So It's definitely tight. I don't think it's necessarily like an easy drive. But I think when I look at a case like this, I look at what's possible and not necessarily what's convenient. And, you know, 1986, traffic patterns being potentially a bit different, I think for me, it's possible. Fun fact about that Beth witness that Zach mentioned, though, I just always thought this was kind of funny. That's a witness where he was supposed to go on this date with a girl the night before that like wrapped up around 2 a.m. And hasn't he made comments, Temujin made comments about like, oh, you know, police hid this witness from me. And it's like, you were on the date with her, dude. Was that, that woman?
I think so.
That, like police were hiding her. And it's like, wouldn't you remember that until you're, anyway, I just,
well, it
was,
I mean, it was proven by FOIA that the prosecution did interview her and did give an interview from her and did not turn it over to the defense. That was FOIA'd and proven.
Well, no, but the thing is, like, it's not, okay, so what I'm talking about is, like, Temujin sometimes tends to overstate things in the mm-hmm. press, where he's basically going out there and being, like, a good example of this is he wants everyone to think that he wasn't allowed to testify, that he was, you know, like, silenced by his own attorney. And then he's out there in the press in 1987, right after the conviction, saying, yeah, I didn't think it would be a good idea if I testified. So, like, there's just certain things like that where it's, like, it would be up, you know, he would know if he went on a date with a woman, he would know who his alibi witnesses were. So there's just some credibility issues about how.
So not so much
that
obviously it's confirmed the defense or the prosecution never turned it over. Yeah. But also, like, I think what you're saying, like, but also, didn't he know that? Didn't
yes.
he know yeah. he was on that date?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Like to bring that up to his own defense. It doesn't excuse what the prosecution did.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
But it's like one of those things where it's like, what is going on here?
Yeah. How did the prosecution, because those are, as I've said, I have, you know, like trying to be very clinical, just looking at like point A, point B and looking away from the other stuff. I look at like, there's the bookend alibi witnesses, right? In the afternoon and the two in the morning and those, like, is it possible, like you said, yeah. So if the bridge was easy to pass that day, because the problem with the bridge is it's hit or miss. There's not like, oh, in 86, it took this long. It's like, no, it one day I've gone over and got stopped for 2 hours and I've other days just cruise right through it and it's no big deal. So it's hard to know. But, you know, if there's like this window of time minus the noon witnesses that works, then I start, you know, I don't know. I just start working at like how tight are, how close are we on that time? And in 1986, to me, it's like that, the idea of I'm going to leave, I'm going to get straight there. How did he know where he was going to be? How did he get there? You know, and these are, and none of these things are like, this proves or disproves anything, but they're the things I have the problem with from a practical point of view, which is like, he just decides at 2 a.m. one day to drive all the way down there. Somehow he knows he's in the parking lot, immediately finds him, shoots him, immediately turns around, drives all the way back. No traffic problems, no car problems, no bridge problems, and gets back. And like, that's what it takes to be possible. It's, again, it doesn't prove it or disprove it, but it certainly, as an investigator, I'm like, ah, that's shaky. And then you throw in the noon witnesses and it's like, God, are, you know, I don't know if they're right, but I mean, there's a whole lot here that like makes it really hard for me to think in practical terms that he did this.
Well, we should remember that he was actively stalking Scott for months and knew his routine, you know, knew what his car looked like, had broken into it on several occasions, I believe. So I think when you look at the pattern of behavior and the fixation on Scott and Crystal, it starts to look less how did he do it and more that he is reentering a situation that he's quite familiar with and acting upon it.
And I'd like to say, at least in my opinion, you know, anything's possible with this guy. I don't believe it was a sudden decision. I think this was something he spent a little bit of time planning. One thing we haven't talked about is that he made a big deal about having car trouble in Escanaba the night before the murder. He had to like go to Kmart and get car parts, and he's telling everybody about how his car is broken down. I think that's a crude attempt to create an alibi. Oh, I couldn't have made this drive. Look, here's solid proof that my car is not working. So I think he had planned all of this out at least a little bit in advance.
I agree.
Okay. And I just remembered where my train of thought was headed when I derailed myself. That alibi, the Beth that you're talking about, The prosecution interviewed her, didn't tell the defense. Temujin knew, didn't tell his defense. How did the prosecution find her?
Good question.
They kind of put out a word they wanted to talk to anybody who had anything to do with him. They're out knocking on doors. So they find her.
Okay, so they were just, so that was a random, they knocked on a door and she's like, oh, I was with him that night.
I think she may have come forward. I don't recall the exact details, to be honest.
And the car trouble thing is interesting to me and yet could be very convenient as well, like you said, to create an alibi. But it's also very interesting to me because I think you have car trouble on either end of this story. You know, the night before the murder is when he gets jumped at Big Boy, which is when he's with Beth and a different acquaintance. And then the night at, or the day of the murder, the night of the murder is the Kmart situation. So it is very interesting to me that there is the possibility that he could have had car trouble or that it's a convenient alibi for himself that there was car trouble.
Because one thing about Temujin Kenzo and people who know him at the time have been always very clear about this with us is that he had access to a ton of vehicles at any given time through borrowing, through having them, like all kinds of kind of vaguely sketchy associations. He had like lots of vehicles in his yard at different times. So access wasn't an issue for him if one car is not working.
Tool Girl in our chat wanted to know, was it proven that he'd broken into Scott's car?
Scott strongly suspected that it was Temujin. There doesn't seem to be any other logical suspect. But if you're asking if it's definitively proven, there's not the equivalent of security cam footage or anything.
Nor would we really expect there to be in 1986. I mean, Scott is dealing with this. He thinks this guy is hung up on Crystal. I don't think he realized the level of danger they were in. So they were starting, I think, to look into getting police involved when Scott's like going to Temujin's place and jotting down plate numbers on the back of his cars because he knows cars are driving past his house at high rates of speed at like midnight. He thinks he's being stalked. He's starting to tell people about it. But as far as like call 911, I think nowadays we might look at this stuff and be like, we're going to call 911 now. Back then, I think it was just like, oh, maybe this guy's just a weird creep. And unfortunately, it just kept escalating.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask too, before I'll move on to if Janet has another question. We, in our conversation, you guys had mentioned him being at a Halloween party, and that got me thinking, it's like, so maybe he wasn't in Escanaba at all. It sounds like, is it pretty well accepted, and this is my ignorance on the case, that regardless of whether he was at the Halloween party or not, that, you know, on November 4th, he was in fact up in Escanaba before the murder. Is that established?
That is established to my satisfaction.
Definitely.
And the thing about the Halloween party is the first time where it's really made public, Scott and Crystal going to get married. Crystal is pregnant. And when Temujin testifies on his own behalf at the commutation hearing, he acknowledges that at the time of the murder, he knew that she was pregnant. So if he wasn't at that party, how would he have gotten that information at that time?
Got it. Janet, do you have other questions of yours?
Yeah, I'm just looking through here. I mean, one of my questions was, again, I know that this is like another sort of unprovable thing. And if you're the prosecutor, you can't have your cake and eat it too. You either say it was him and he was there and it was him in person, or potentially if there really are no other viable suspects that anyone can find or even imagine, then the idea of like a hitman or something more casual than that comes up. And that's something that DM had posted on our Facebook, is what do you think about the theory that he may have hired a hitman? If you're unwilling to walk away from, like, if you're willing to accept that the alibis work, but part of that is part of his plan to then also have the alibi to show that he couldn't have been the person to actually pull the trigger, is it possible that someone else could have been involved?
I think it's an interesting theory. And in a way, I like it because people who believe that are acknowledging what I frankly think is obvious, which is that no one else had a motive to kill Scott other than Temujin Kinzu. And also, legally speaking, if you hire a hitman or do something more casual that you're doing the essence of hiring the hitman, you're still guilty of murder. You're still going to spend the rest of your life in prison. With all of that said, I don't find it plausible, and I say that for a couple of reasons, one of which is that if Temujin Kinzu goes to someone and says, I want you to commit this murder for me, that person now has power over Temujin Kinzu for the rest of his life. And Temujin Kinzu has to worry, anytime this guy gets in trouble or anytime he gets mad at me, he might turn me in. And Temujin Kinzu, when I look at him, he's a man who's all about trying to get power and leverage over others. I don't see him putting himself in that situation. And then the other facts of the matter is, I don't think of him as being an especially bright man, Temujin Kinzu, but I do think he has at least average intelligence. And if it's a hitman, he has hired a hitman who looks very much like him. I believe the witnesses at the parking lot.
That'd be bad.
Yeah, I believe they saw Temujin.
I got a plan, guys.
Exactly.
My twin.
And why? If you don't believe those witnesses saw Temujin Kinzu, you have to believe at the very least they saw somebody who not only strongly resembled Temujin Kinzu, but was wearing a coat that matched a coat that's found in Temujin Kinzu's trunk. So Temujin Kinzu hires his twin, and then says, oh, you look a little chilly, borrow my coat.
And give it back to me afterwards so I can put it back in my car. Also, I don't
find that plausible. And
I think he would have had a heck of a better alibi if he had hired a hitman. You know, I mean, I try to put myself in the murderer's shoes a little bit. I'm sure we all do that. It's a bit morbid. But wouldn't you be getting in like a bunch of fender benders that day in town or getting into a big public thing with somebody? Like, I think, you know, instead what we have is like, the karate studio people think they remember him, and everyone else says, hey, you were trying to manipulate me into saying I remembered you. And I just think he would have had a better situation for himself.
Hey, everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
This is completely an aside, so it's the worst thing for me to interrupt you with, but
do it.
So here we go.
That's what I want.
Here we go. You ready for it? Ready for this professional segue?
Can't wait. Can't wait.
Listen, there's a little teaser for Sunday's episode. You had mentioned, you said something about how, you know, the prosecution can't have their cake and eat it too. If you're not familiar with the DeForest Johnson case, which is the ear witness case, that imagine a prosecutor has nothing to do with this case that we're talking about. But this prosecutor put somebody on trial for capital murder saying they shot a cop, gets their conviction and sentenced them to death. And 2 months later, puts someone else on trial for the same crime and says, the same prosecutor, and says they were the shooter, they shot the cop in the head, and tries to put them to death too. The same prosecutor, while he's got this guy on death row for murder, is in front of a jury telling them that it was this guy over here that did it instead. That's just a little aside. That was worth interrupting you for.
That's uncomfortable.
More of that on Sunday.
That's uncomfortable. That's very uncomfortable. Yeah, and it was the jacket. I think I remember hearing on some coverage somewhere that the jacket that was found that was similar to what the person was said to be wearing, they did test. Did they test it for like gunpowder residue and they didn't find any? But I don't know the timeline of like when they even found it or tested it.
Yeah, I heard that on Framed. I don't know what Aaron's source is for that. I can't recall offhand. So I don't have a definitive answer to that.
And I just want to point out, too, because somebody had mentioned something in the chat, too. I don't know how to say this other than it seems to me that, and you guys can just correct me if I'm wrong about this too, that because we talked a little bit about this on Sunday's episode, that like a lot of these witness statements are kind of up for interpretation. They change, they blend, we kind of work them together. So I just get real uncomfortable. Like when and I don't know if the jacket thing is one that's much more solid, that's fine. I just want to make sure that I'm clearly pointing out if it was, you know, there was this person said this, it was kind of like this, that we don't turn that into, it was very clear all the witnesses saw somebody wearing this jacket. And I don't know what, where they were at with that, but I just wanted to, with that, was it very clear from the witnesses that this is the jacket, or was that another thing that was kind of interpretation leads us to believe that it was that jacket?
I think it was pretty clear that you have multiple witnesses describing a white man, I think of above average
height. With a green military jacket. Right?
With a green military jacket obviously, and a watch cap.
Obviously, there's no way of saying the jacket in the trunk, even if it looks exactly like the jacket the witnesses saw, there's no way of absolutely proving that's definitely the same jacket. I want to be honest about that. But it's consistent with that jacket.
Yeah, we tend to see that facts like that is kind of adding to the totality of circumstances that convict Temujin in our eyes. Not that anyone should be convicted on any one of those points, but when you add them all together, it creates sum.
After I said I was remembering Green Army Jack, it was like I had in my mind Janet and Zach. I was thinking of our season 15 of the Jody Hill jacket.
Oh yeah,
where it was like it was like a witness said they saw someone wearing a black jacket with a gray stripe on it. And then, like, the prosecution turned that into this, like, Michigan starter jacket that was, like, blue and maize and white. And they, like, put a black and white photo of it and tried to, you know, so, like, that's what I was picturing in my mind. I forgot until you just mentioned it. In this case, it was, like, everybody said, like, green army jacket, right? Yeah.
They were pretty consistent. And you know, only one witness was like, it is this man specifically. Others are describing someone who matches Temujin Kinzu, but they're not testifying in court. And necessarily doing the, like, he's sitting right there kind of thing.
Right, so, right, right.
You know, I don't feel like they were stretching on that.
Mm-hmm. I want to make sure we get into some of the listener questions that are specifically for Kevin and Anya. Molly says, how much did the ninja or teleporting language factor into the case? Was Crystal actually claiming Temujin had magical powers, or is she using colorful language to describe coercive control and how evasive he could be?
Yeah, it's a great question. And yeah, Crystal's not a lunatic. You know, I mean, this is a young woman who went through something really horrible, you know, goes on a date with a guy, and then it basically turns into like a weeks long hostage crisis where she's being viciously sexually and physically abused. And she ultimately had the wherewithal to get out of that. And I think when she's talking about the things he told her, they sound really outlandish. You know, and Council of Ninjas is watching us. That's ridiculous. But that is what he told her. And the reason why I believe Crystal on this is we've talked to other women who were with Temujin Kinzu, and he told them all the same thing. He had a playbook. He had like a script, and it's an outlandish script. But I think it's fair when you see one person saying something that's a pretty wild story, looking at it and saying, well, is that consistent with this man's behavior in other relationships? But when you're seeing all these women who don't know each other, who are separated by geography and time and all these things, I think she was describing the kind of coercive control and threats that he was making to her. And I think he wanted her to feel, I can be anywhere, I can get anywhere, you won't even see me coming, and I will kill you and people you love if you tell anyone what I'm doing to you. And I think she was a very devastating witness for him.
Yeah, it's also, I mean, if you go down that road, it's also kind of this like very disturbing, perfect storm where you're saying something that is insane, but you have control over a person who then essentially believes it. And then when they say he could do this, he said this, you can also be the person that's like, doesn't that sound crazy? who would say that? Who would say they had a bunch of ninjas? Come on, don't listen to her. Like, it's sort of diabolical in that way, if you believe that went down like that.
And to me, it's also really ironic because people have mocked Crystal for years of like, she watched too many ninja movies. Ha ha, women.
No, he watched too many ninja movies.
Yeah, but then it's like, okay, we're not noticing that this extremely white Caucasian dude changed his name to this fake ass Asian name. Like, I'm sorry, like, as no one picked, like, maybe he had a fixation on this stuff and maybe he was telling women some weird stuff. But it does really bother me when people go after Crystal. I mean, she lost the father of her child. She went through all this. I 100% believe her. I believe the other women. And to me, I'm very much okay with people saying, hey, it's not enough evidence for me, or I have a different viewpoint on this case. But when people are kind of like mocking their experiences, I think it just bothers me. I don't think that's right. I don't think it's necessary. And I think it's important that we kind of maintain some ethical standards when we're talking about some of those experiences, because, you know, we never know who might be listening, who might have gone through their own situation. And to make people feel isolated, like no one will believe you, it's just, I don't think it's right.
I do have a question too from Lucy and Molly. And this actually speaks to something that I wasn't aware of until I listened to your coverage about the whole plane thing. Because you said, you know, like, if he's the one who kept insisting, like, well, one thing's for sure, I never could have flown, I know I didn't fly, then the prosecutor's like, huh, why does he keep saying that? And then they use that. So Lucy and Molly said, where did the airplane theory come from, and what evidence supports it? If investigators believe the alibi witnesses were unreliable, why didn't they try to disprove those alibis instead of relying on an unconfirmed flight? And my memory is that the prosecutor sort of launched that out as a Hail Mary pass in his closing argument. Maybe I'm misremembering that, but if that is indeed true, do you guys think that was a mistake because it became so much about that in the kind of innocence work that was being done?
Yeah, your memory is pretty close, not quite 100%, but it's pretty close. The whole plane theory did kind of come from Kinzu, as you say, because he was going around making those comments. Oh, you'd have to have a plane and all this other stuff. So yeah, I think that was probably in the back of some of their minds. It's been characterized as this was a huge part of the trial, and it wasn't. The prosecution presented their case. They cross-examined the alibi witnesses that were presented by Mr. Kinzu. But then after the defense presents its case, the prosecution has the chance to put on what's called rebuttal witnesses, which is,
the defense, the pilot.
Yeah. Yes. So the defense put on somebody saying, oh, I saw him at this karate shop. And so the prosecutors just not wanting to leave anything undone or untaken care of are concerned, oh, what if we didn't do as good a job as we thought in cross-examination? What if some people do believe he was there in that karate shop? Well, for rebuttal, why don't we put on a witness, this pilot, who can talk about the possibility that he took a plane. And that's how he was able to be in Escanaba and Port Huron that day. And so they did that. But they also, it's worth noting, they did disprove these alibi witnesses, at least in my mind, through their cross-examination. And the jurors in a newspaper interview right after the case ended saying, we did not believe those alibi witnesses. And to answer your question, there's really no evidence for the helicopter theory. It was just
the plane theory.
The plane
theory. Now we're breaking out a helicopter. Yeah. But what
else? Also, the submarine theory is bullshit.
We got a train, maybe? Who knows?
it was something that was a very small part of the trial that advocates for him repeat out of context because, frankly, it sounds ridiculous.
It sounds also extra ridiculous, like post 9/11, like what he got in the plane, like just flying around. I mean, I think I don't like the plane theory. I believe he drove, like, for what it's worth. Yeah. Like, I don't buy it. And they didn't really have, like, the evidence. They, you know, what, like, who flew him? What happened? I will say, though, just to be fair, 1986, rural Michigan, I think it's a little bit different. We've been looking into some things about possible connections he had with some maybe shadier people. But to me, they basically destroyed the karate studio people on the stand as far as the jury was concerned. And the jury was like, yeah, we didn't buy it because he was calling too many people. So the jury seemed to be leaning toward the driving as well. That was what the case was about. Rebuttal witnesses are not like your main case in chief where it's like, this is all important and you have to, you know, this is what we're leading with. It's as Kevin said, it's more of like, all right, you know, just in case you're not convinced by our cross-examination of those witnesses, maybe he flew a plane.
They set him up and then you just got to do something to knock everything down before you get to the end of it, you know?
It's just hard because, yeah, if somebody can turn around and say like, well, we checked the flight logs and nothing like that happened, don't throw out something like that, that like potentially contaminates the better work that you've done, you know, with the alibi witnesses, because then it does get.
If the prosecutor only knew there would be a thing called true crime podcast decades later.
It's
going to get mocked relentlessly to millions of people.
I will say this, and this has no bearing one way or the other, but I remember when Undisclosed did the coverage, I think probably he didn't do it. I but, you know, again, like, do I have a problem with him being in prison? Some ethical quandaries there. When I was in college, the end of my freshman year, my boyfriend at the time and I missed the last bus out of Flagstaff, Arizona, going to Tucson for like spring break or whatever it was. And we did not have cars and we did not know how we were going to get back to Southern Arizona. I don't know. I don't remember who suggested it, but someone was like, why don't you go to the airport? The tiny little Flagstaff, like non-public air, you know, the private airport, and just like see if anyone is flying to Phoenix. And we legit paid like $50 to some dude who had like barely a four-seater and flew down to Phoenix. I thought I was going to barf the entire way. But like, I was a poor college student, had no money, and somehow ended up in a plane going over the forests of Northern Arizona like with my legs squished into the back of the seat of the pilot, being like, how is this happening right now?
When you got there, did you tell him, like, I flew private, no big deal?
Yeah. I personally can say I was in like a little like propeller putter plane for no money and got to Phoenix. So that was the funny thing about like that particular part. Like, I was like, I'm sure he is innocent, but like the idea that he couldn't have made that happen, or that there was, that it would have cost a ton of money. I just remember that being a big deal, them being like, he didn't have any money. I was like, neither did I. So that was just a weird thing that I kind of had to like, I had to dismiss that, you know, part.
You had your own personal plane theory situation, but yeah. I will say he had money, this man. Like everyone says that he was broke, but you know how he got money? Temujin was, his notorious scheme was he would have women he was with and then basically threaten them into going door to door with a coffee cup with like some kind of fake charity printed out around it, and collecting money for fake charities that they would then turn over to him. So that's something I always found interesting.
In a perfect world, if Temujin Kenzu is innocent, if he was, would be that he's exonerated and then put in prison for all the other crimes that he should have been put in prison for afterwards.
Fair
and then
enough.
Everybody's happy. We've got a couple more questions, Janet, but we're running long. So what I'd like to do is, I think we've covered most of the stuff, but Sarah's question under the ones for Bob and group, I think we'll end on that one.
Sarah says, if Temujin's conviction were overturned and the state charged him again, would prosecutors be bound to their original theory of the case, or could they introduce new evidence or a different theory?
If he gets a new trial, the prosecution can present whatever evidence they currently feel is their best bet. So they could introduce different or new material. If they wanted to go after him on a hitman theory, they could do that. And again, if he hired a hitman to do it, that would still be first degree murder.
And Michigan's an aiding and abetting state. So
Yeah. So it wouldn't make the least bit of difference in terms of his sentence.
Yeah. And that's a perfect segue into my pitch for Sunday. Again, is make sure you tune in from Beth from season 4 of Bone Valley, where she covered Ear Witness. Because in that one, they not just like a conviction overturned, but tried the same person multiple times, and every time comes up with it. The prosecution in that case throughout all the trials has presented 5 different theories to juries. So they are certainly not bound from the original theory. Kevin, Anya, thank you so much for joining us. This has been great. I do want to sometime in the near future, like in the next couple weeks, let's try to hook up and have a conversation about Delphi. Zach and Janet, obviously, thank you guys for being here as always, and listeners for joining us. And we'll talk to all you guys next week.
Cool. Bye, everybody. Thanks.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kate Wood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page.
can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Ugh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Britsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.